Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hey, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for June 17th, 2012. Happy Father's Day to everyone. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, Catherine Smith.
Happy Father's Day from Atlanta, everybody.
And Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about a good many topics tonight as we are running with just the three of us. No guests tonight, but there was plenty of political news, so that shouldn't be a problem. We also are going to tackle something we had alluded to about a week or two ago on the show, the 538 state-by-state election forecast. This just came out right at the end of May, early June, and we hadn't had time to go through it southern state by southern state, and we're going to take that chance tonight in a little while. But in the meantime, something I didn't know until this morning when I was watching, or I guess early afternoon when I was watching Chris Matthews, is this is the 40th anniversary of the Watergate break-in. It happened 40 years ago today. Obviously, it wasn't known about that night, even though apparently Forrest Gump, according to Chris Matthews' clip, reported the break-in. I'd actually forgotten that from the movie. But anyway, it was 40 years ago today. Obviously, that it's probably one of the pivotal political events in the past, say, 50 years, because mistrust of Washington and politicians probably spiked up after that event more than any one single thing probably in the last half century. And it's real funny that they talk a lot about it on Chris Matthews. They spend a ton of time on it. But if you look on the blogosphere, a lot of places on the Internet that cover politics, not even mentioned. I mean, if you look at Daily Kos, wasn't mentioned. Red State, wasn't mentioned. I'm sure Politico didn't even mention it. I guess they're too busy covering the current political environment. But, Tim, I guess you're the senior of us. I was not even a year old when Watergate happened. Tell us, how big of an impact did this make on American politics?
Well, it made a huge, huge impact on it, David. Of course, I remember it all quite well, and the whole country just simply watched in fascination
as much of this drama was played out on television. One of the central characters in this whole thing, in the Watergate hearings, was our own Senator Talmadge here in Georgia. It was known, of course, about the break-in and all before the election, but the public really didn't pay that much attention until the following year. And then it just took up all the air in the room in 1973. Essentially, the political world exploded. I can't say that I was that surprised, considering Richard Nixon's career. He always seemed to be in something like that. But it seemed to me that people's perception of the government has never been the same since that happened. People lost a faith in the highest echelons of government that they've never really gotten back. And it was just a sad chapter in our history, and really, really, really bad. It was a tremendous thing.
Yes. Catherine, your thoughts on Watergate?
Well, I was 15, so I remember it. We watched it every night on the news in my house, and I absolutely agree with Tim. I think it was a very destructive incident for our country, for sort of our trust in government. And then we went, later we got into the Iran-Contra scandal, and it just seemed like all these things chipped away at our confidence in our government. And I agree. I don't think we've ever been the same, and I don't know how you get that back. I don't know that confidence.
Probably hadn't. And I've got two more questions. I'm going to ask y'all each a different question, And Catherine, I'll come to you first. I, of course, I've looked at Watergate more as history because I was so young. But when I look at it, I see, you know, the 72 presidential returns. George McGovern just got dismantled. I mean, his, it was one of the most lopsided elections in history. And my question always would be, why in the world did Nixon and his campaign even feel it necessary to do this? You know, it's bad to cheat, but it's just dumb to cheat when you don't have to. I mean, Kevin, why in the world did he feel compelled to do this?
Because he was absolutely paranoid. I mean, he was so paranoid about, you know, he had his whole enemies list, and I mean, he was very, I mean, he's always been, it's always been acknowledged that he was, well, not always, but since he's not been president, that he was, you know, sort of constantly worried about, you know, people trying to take his power, and, you know, he really wanted to control people, and he really wanted that power of the presidency. And I don't think it mattered to him whether he thought there was any chance that he might lose or not. It was just that this is what he had to do because he was so paranoid.
Okay, and Tim, I'm going to ask you a different question. Given that you're a lifelong Georgia resident and were alive through the, between 72 and 76, without Watergate, does Jimmy Carter ever get elected president? And because Watergate may be so instrumental in him being elected, would you say that Watergate affected the state of Georgia more than any other state just because its own son became president?
Yeah, there is no way on this earth that Jimmy Carter ever becomes president without Watergate, David, because Gerald Ford would not have pardoned Richard Nixon, and that was probably the chief contributing factor in President Ford's defeat. But Watergate was bound to happen. That's the second part of that answer, because of the type man that Catherine alluded to that Richard Nixon was. Watergate was not their first break-in. You know, Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers in 1970, so this little group they called the Plumbers went out to Los Angeles and broke in Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to see what kind of dirt they could get on him to discredit him. And it was the same bunch that launched these break-ins into Watergate 2 years later.
Yeah, well, let's continue. I mean, Watergate, that's kind of the final question I have for both of you. Watergate has not been covered, the 40th anniversary, in the current political scene other than Chris Matthews' seeming fascination with it. Why has there been so little discussion of it on the blogosphere and other political media sources? Catherine, I'm going to ask you first, and then Tim, you can follow up.
Well, I have heard a little bit about it, like on, because there was another book came out recently. I meant to look it up this afternoon, and I didn't, that sort of revealed even more about Richard Nixon's paranoia. And so I heard a little bit about it on the news a couple weeks ago, I guess, as the anniversary was approaching. But like you said in the intro, I think we're also wound up in the current political dynamics that, you know, what happened 40 years ago isn't really that important to us currently, because, you know, we got to talk about everything else that's going on and heckling and, you know.
Yeah. Well, we'll get there, Tim.
Tea parties and.
Yeah. It's what, just echoing what Catherine pretty well said, David, it's so long ago, 40% of the present voters have no memory at all of Watergate. They know of it only what they read in the, you know, papers and in the history books, and what somebody like Fred Thompson, who was involved in it, might get on TV and say. That's about it. And it's too bad, too, because you know what? If they lose the lessons of Watergate, and the main lesson is that power does corrupt. They're going to do it again. It's going to happen again, and we already see it starting to happen with this huge amount of money suddenly flowing into the political process. Now, that was one of the things about Watergate. A lot of that stopped after they passed laws to stop it. And unfortunately, those laws are now being struck down by the Supreme Court, and here we go again.
Well, I think the other lesson from Watergate that has gone unlearned, sort of, is that investigative journalism is very important. I mean, if the Washington Post had not allowed those two reporters to follow their leads, follow, you know, minuscule ideas about something that was going on for months and months and months, and they took lots and lots of ridicule for it, we would never have learned the depth to which, the length and depth to which the president had gone to, you know, cover this up and all that stuff. So, and I don't think we have very many investigative journalists like that in this country anymore. Or we don't have papers that will allow that extensive, long-term investigative process.
Yeah, because if you don't sell papers today or sell page views or whatever it may be, it's hard to get out there.
So
the media is definitely transformed. Yes, Tim.
Yeah, just think, David, those two guys were two little old city reporters on the city desk there. And Ben Bradley asked them one question. Are you guys sure about this? Yes. All right, go ahead with it. Now, would that happen today? Probably not.
Well, it might happen today. Like, part of it might happen today, but the length of time and the amount of money that the Washington Post put behind that story, they're just letting them run with it. And they took tons of ridicule for it from other papers and, you know, it was, and even from within the Washington Post. So, and, you know, Catherine, what's her name?
Graham.
She was very supportive of it, too. She was all about it. Like, she let them go with it, too. But I don't think most publishers and editors would allow that. Now, it's just too expensive.
Yeah. Well, it's obviously something that has a big impact, and it's just kind of sad that it wasn't talked about more this weekend for whatever reason. Maybe in 10 years it'll be discussed a little more with 50 years. Well, let's continue to move forward into today. And, Catherine, you alluded to the heckling. We'll actually talk about the press conference that led to the heckling first, and then we will get to the heckling and the lack of decorum. But the president made another big sweeping announcement. I mean, this was made much the same way as the gay marriage announcement a few months ago. He is changing a procedure to sign, I guess, part of the DREAM Act into law. And what that means is if you were brought into this country when you were a minor and have been here for an extended period of time, probably have formulas that would get too mathy and boring for us to discuss. But, I mean, that's the gist of it. You can stay in this country legally. And so this is people that have definitely been raised in America, if you will, even if they were born in another country, probably in particular, this is targeted towards Mexican immigrants. I guess we could discuss the political calculus of this, which I think a lot of it may be, is how do you think this helps the president, hurts the president, impacts the president's campaign? Tim.
Well, I'm gonna take a different tack here because I believe in the long run, if the economy does not improve some more, then I really don't know if this particular item will make that much difference. It might make a little difference in some states like
New Mexico, Colorado, Nevada. It'll certainly help the president with the Hispanic community.
It was a politically calculated thing, even though I'm glad that he did it. And I think the opposition is not going to come at it from the standpoint that it was the wrong thing to do. I think the way they're going to try to attack this is question whether the president had the authority to even do it. What do you think?
Yeah. I think you're right, they may. That way they don't seem anti-Hispanic,
right.
Which obviously the Republican Party is hurting among Hispanic voters. Catherine, your thoughts on it?
Well, I agree that it's really going to be all about the economy, like Tim said. But I think that this helps the president not only with the Latino population and the Latino voters, but I think it helps a lot with younger and more progressive voters, because I think that there's a lot of people who are frustrated with the fact that the president hasn't acted on what some people view as like more progressive issues. And I think that just following some of my friends' comments on Facebook and just sort of hearing, you know, conversations, I think that it does make people who were, you know, maybe supporters of the president but farther to the left and frustrated by him, I think it gives them a little lift too. I think not just Latinos, but people who either support a more open society, and so I think it helps him in that way. I think there is a question about whether he has the authority, and that will probably come up from the Republicans. I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a judge. So I can't really look at. I don't know if he does or not, but I'm sure that'll be their challenge. I don't think they'll challenge. I don't think they want to do anything else negative about the Latino community.
Dave,
yeah, I mean, go ahead, Tim.
David, I want before you start in with your comments, I want to add this because I want you to address it. President Obama is the only president in the history of this country that has ever been elected while losing the white vote by double digits. How will this announcement affect that?
Well, I mean, you're meaning he would lose it by more? Or
Would he? That's my question
all,
to
I mean,
you.
Are you saying in 2008 he lost the white vote by double digits?
Yes.
Okay, so he obviously did it once by losing the white vote in double digits, so you could, I guess, argue that he wouldn't need to hold as much white vote as you would think, or it may be that the white vote that he won last time, he's not going to lose much because of this. I mean, obviously, I think it would be good if the president, the Democratic Party in general, you know, tried to see if they could get a larger percentage of the white vote, because obviously there's some states just can't only get minorities and win elections. I mean, you have to get a larger percentage of the white vote than you're getting. For instance, I think we looked at a poll from North Carolina that showed him losing a big percentage of black voters, like 20%, say. I mean, it's obviously for the president. But then the white vote, he was getting like 36%. And I was sitting there going, well, if he could get 36% of the white vote in a southern state, that's pretty good in a southern state.
Yeah.
So all that figures in. There was an article on the Democratic Strategist by Alan Abramovitz, which I believe he's from Emory University, and he said that the Democratic Party should ignore swing voters and focus on voter registration and mobilization and getting voters to the polls. This kind of move seems to reinforce that. You're making sure that Hispanic voters turn out for you. They have motivation to. Maybe also, I guess you'd say, younger voters might have more motivation to. Now, with swing voters, I mean, I don't know how this would affect the swing voters, because obviously every swing voter is different. They may, find this a very defensible position they don't really have a problem with, because this is not just saying, hey, we've knocked down our border. We're saying that you can come in this country, or if you've been brought in this country not as a minor, not by your own adult decision illegally, and you've lived over here for some time, then we're letting you stay where you were brought I won't say against your will, but parents, so you weren't making your own adult decisions. So that is a very different position than saying, hey, we're just not having any more immigration rules.
I ask that question for a political reason, and that is a couple of generations ago when I was a kid, I saw this played out before. The Civil Rights Bill passed. And boy, I was all for it, and I've always been proud that it was a president from our party that signed it into law. But it did produce a political realignment in this country. The political map did change. And I was just wondering if this will be the new civil rights thing of this generation that might again produce a realignment of the map. For instance, will the Rocky Mountain states and the southwestern states, because of the larger percentage of Hispanic voters, suddenly become reliable Democratic territory as a result of this? What do you think?
I think Hispanic voters may become more and more Democratic, and of course that causes some real problems for the GOP in a lot of places. Because, you know, at some point you have to think that younger white voters become more swing voters, more Democratic voters, and therefore if the Republicans don't have anything to add to it other than older white voters, then, you know, they're just going to get demographically squeezed out of office a lot of places.
Yeah, they're going to run out of older white voters. I mean, nature being
what it is.
Yeah,
they're going to run out of older white voters.
Yeah, they're not getting any younger, as you might say. Well, Catherine, jump in here and give us your thoughts.
I think there is a potential for a realignment. I think that a lot depends on, I mean, you know, Latino voters don't just vote on immigration. In fact, a lot of Latino voters who are already here, have been here for generations, aren't as concerned about immigration as, you know, they're just as concerned about jobs and the economy and housing as every other person. I have a friend who's like a third-generation Latino living in metro Atlanta, and she is very frustrated by this constant attention that the Latino community gets about immigration. She said, don't get me wrong, I want fair immigration rules, but we have a lot of other issues that are important to us that get put to the side because everybody thinks we're concerned about immigration. So I think it's not a simple, oh, if we, you know, pass part of the DREAM Act, we'll get all the Latino votes. So, you know, it's a good first step, but there's other things that, you know, the same issues that concern you and Tim and me and all of us are part of what the Latino Americans are concerned about. So it's not a simple solution, but I do think it's a step in the right direction.
Hey, David. I have another question for you, and John McCain put it forth this morning. He said, not that it was the wrong thing to do, he said, but 2 years ago, the president had super majorities in both houses of the Congress and never moved on this issue. Is he right to question that?
Basically, I guess you could say to any president that comes into office with a majority, if they don't do everything they support the very first day and they space things out throughout their term, you know, you could always say, hey, shouldn't they have done that right off? I mean, can you always make that argument? They should have done it right off.
You could. I'm asking you. Does McCain have a point?
I mean, no, I think that happens with every president or politician, governor, whatever it is. They come in, and there's still stuff to do. They have to, you know, space out their agenda, if you will. I mean, shouldn't Bush have pushed through the privatizing of Social Security right off? Instead, he waited to the first year of his second term. He waited even later on a signature issue for him. I mean, shouldn't John McCain have criticized him, if you will? Just a thought to make. Well, let's kind of phase into the next half of this. And the president, you know, had a press event, if you will. He was, you know, giving a little speech announcing the policy change. And while he's doing this, a blogger, Neil Monroe, from the Conservative, and the name leaves me real quick. I'm trying to actually find it. Right Online, or actually he's a Right Online conference blogger, I guess. No, he's from the Daily Caller. Hard to find where this guy's actually from. He just speaks up out of nowhere and just starts, it's almost not like a question. It's almost like he's giving his opinion of what he thinks of the policy change. And my question is, obviously this is a lack of decorum. A lot of bloggers on the right side even say what he, the way he handled this was completely wrong, even if they might have agreed with the guy, what he was saying. But my question is, and Catherine, I'm going to come to you this first, if he's trying to make blogging a legitimate news source, don't you think this kind of behavior hurts that? And if he wants to promote blogging as a new form of journalism, does he have to behave in a different way?
Yes. He was addressing the president, and it was rude. It was just flat out unacceptable. I mean, it would have been that way. I would have felt that way no matter who was talking. He was addressing a crowd of people. He interrupted him, and I mean, he's the president. But even if it wasn't a president, it's not the appropriate thing to do. And he backed away from it, saying, "Oh, I thought he was finished." Well, no, you didn't. You know, I wanted to make sure I got my question because I thought he was going to leave before he took any questions. And, you know, I just thought it was childish and immature and rude. And I think it shows a lack of respect for the presidency. And I think we see it, you know, that was a really glaring example of it. But I think you see it all the time. You hear it all the time on talk radio. You see it on television, on Fox News, and it really bothers me. And it's a big disappointment to me, actually, honestly.
Yeah, every once in a while we have something like this creep up where one, feel rude to the president, and two, some of these bloggers. I think there was one guy that had like his personal listings, and it was kind of strange, and he had covered some press events, and it's just when bloggers come up at press events in a negative way like this, it hurts the concept of blogging, which there are hundreds and thousands of people in the blogosphere that want to legitimately cover politics in the appropriate way. It's just a new way to discuss, like papers were before, and you know, many, many generations before. So this guy, I think, definitely needs to be you know, where he can't come to big events like this anymore and cover for a while, because he's pretty much, you know, I guess you might say rescinded his right to come. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, first of all, there are a limited number of these press passes given out, you know, for these announcements, for the press room and stuff like that. And, you know, I don't know the pecking order, but I would have to think that Tucker Carlson's website, the Daily Caller, or whatever it's called, would be way, way down the list. The first thing I've got to ask is, why was somebody like this guy even there anyway? To me, only the major outlets should be there, because they're the only ones that have earned the right to be there, legitimate-wise. And secondly, we're not just talking about interrupting the president here. We're talking about interrupting a president when he is making an official announcement 5 feet from the door of the White House.
Exactly.
You know, on the grounds of the White House. And that guy, the excuses he gave don't hold water. He meant to show himself and argue with the president. As a matter of fact, when the president did try to answer his questions, the guy tried to interrupt him again, and he had to tell the guy, you know, I'm answering questions. I'm not here to argue with you, We're not here to have an argument, which is what the guy wanted to do and get his 15 minutes of fame in or whatever. So I think the guy went there looking to do this, and, you know, that's, you know, he ought to just go ahead and tell the truth and say that's what he did. But I got to agree with you on one thing, that guy will never see the grounds of the White House again while Barack Obama's president. So,
yeah, and you mentioned the Daily Caller and Tucker Carlson. Well, you would think that Tucker Carlson, I mean, this is a guy that's been on CNN hosting a show. Really, I mean, had some class about him. I remember when he was on Crossfire and he mentioned that Hillary Clinton's book would never sell a certain amount of books, and if it did, he'd eat a shoe. And then she very graciously had a shoe cake cooked and came on, and he laughed and he apologized to her. And, I mean, he has a little, you know, the way he conducts himself is not the way that, you know, Neil Monroe did. And you'd have to think that he as his boss would be livid at the way this was done. And
you
this
would
guy
think
may
that.
Be in hot water at the Daily Caller.
You would think that, but from what I've heard, Carlson actually tried to defend this guy's actions.
Yeah.
And was dressed down by some other Republicans for doing that. So,
yeah, because they obviously, if they make this the issue instead of whatever they want to make the issue, then that hurts them.
There is no positive that comes out of this for the Republicans. They hope this goes away.
Yeah, they just, this is where the, you know, the Tea Party folks, they may love it, but they're in their corner anyway. I mean, this is play into the base.
Right.
Well, you know, we're actually halfway through this show, and we haven't even gotten to our big topic. So to give it the appropriate amount of time, we better get to it, and then whatever time we got left, we can move on. So if you're at home and you want to go to 538.blog.newyorktimes.com and follow along the right side, feel free. And they have this little map on the right side that has every state in the nation, and further than that, down than that, they have a little drop down. You can go to state by state, if you will. You can also look at which state's most likely to be the tipping point, which state's likely to give you the best return on investment. And if you look at those last two maps, the only states that even look in the South that look decent are Virginia and Florida, if you will. But we're going to go around this thing, and I guess to kind of get a little geographic continuity going on, let's go ahead and start with Florida, and then we can just move our way around the South and end a little north of there in our own home state. It says right now, if the election were held, or I guess based on today's information, Romney has a 63.3 chance of winning. I personally think that's a little high. I see Florida as almost a 50-50 state. If they wanted to tip it just a little bit one way or the other, I could see it. One thing I definitely think is the president's favor is Bill Nelson is running just under him on the ticket and running well at this point. So I do think that if the Senate race was closer, it might make it tougher for the president. But with that going on, it's definitely a down-to-the-wire state, not a 63% chance. Catherine, what do you think of this one?
I agree with you. I think those numbers are out of whack. I think that Romney has the edge a little bit, but I think that edge could come off, you know, with the right amount of effort in Florida from the Obama campaign.
So, yeah, and we don't always have to put a number. If somebody wants to put a number on these things.
Yeah, I'm not good at that.
Be my guest. That gets, you know, once again, a little math intensive. But we can just kind of go over under, if you will. Tim, what do you think? 63.3.
Way, the odds are way out of bounds. Real Clear Politics has this race separated in Florida by 0.2 of a percent when you average all the public opinion polls together. I got to think just the slightest edge to Romney, the trends seem to indicate he might win Florida by 1 to 3 points, but that would just about be all. This state's going to be close, and it's not going to be called early on election night.
Yes. Well, let's continue to move on, and I'm going to move on geographically due west, and that means I'm going to touch Alabama. They have Alabama at a 99.9% chance of a Romney win. It's kind of funny how they'll have one state being 100 and one being 99.9 and one being 99.8 and one being 97.4. But I really don't see a scenario in which the president wins Alabama. I mean, I remember in 96, President Clinton campaigned in Alabama, and they were like, why is he spending time? And there was some polling showing that he was starting to make it close, and he didn't get there. So I think Alabama is one of those long-term projects for the Democratic Party, at least on the presidential level. Hopefully for the Democrats in the state, they can begin to start figuring how to win, you know, just statewide races in their border. So I'll give them 99.9. What do you think, Catherine?
Oh, I'm going to agree with that. I'll actually give them 100%.
You'll get another. We'll get that 0.1 we took away on Florida.
Yeah, I can't argue with anybody on this. There's just no way. No way. No way's close.
Okay. As the president moves west, things get better. It goes to 99.8. He gets a whole tenth of a point better in Mississippi. I don't know. These states are so similar. I mean, they're mirror images of each other as far as the shape almost, with their panhandles dipping down in the Gulf of Mexico. A lot of their state history is similar. Their demographics are similar. I really, the bigger question here is not if this number's right, because once again, Mississippi's a long-term project. What's the thing that makes Mississippi a tenth of a point better is my bigger question. Tim or Catherine, any answers on that?
I don't know what that. Oh, go ahead.
I do. There'd be a bigger percentage of the vote in Mississippi if they come and vote that would be African American. So
maybe
it would be a little bit closer. A little bit closer than it would be in Alabama. But
here's the problem. There's more potential.
Yeah, here's the problem. What Democrats in statewide races have also earned the potential lately of getting about 15% of the white vote, which, of course, means the math is not in the ballpark to even make this state competitive with those numbers.
I always do the
downer that makes you pause and say yes. You ever notice that?
Yeah, I did. I was thinking. I did figure a way that the president or people in support of the president might could make certainly Alabama a little closer. I think if you know how Alabama likes to get all these recruits from out of state to come to the University of Alabama in particular, some to Auburn. I think if some of the biggest recruits around the country, if they're young African-Americans, said, look, if the president carries Alabama, and some of them go to Alabama and some of them go to University of Auburn, then he might have a chance in Alabama. I don't know if that works in Mississippi, but it might in Alabama, as football crazy as they are. What do you think, Tim?
No.
That wouldn't get it done.
No.
That wouldn't get it done.
There you go.
Okay. But that would be the best strategy I can think of. Okay, Louisiana. Now, this is a state that used to sort of be a southern swing state back in the 90s, but the southern Republican wave and Katrina combined have made it just getting worse. I think it's one of the most Republican trending states in the nation. They have it as a 99.6. I almost think that it's tied up with Mississippi and Alabama, and certainly it wouldn't have been anywhere near there. Several years before. Is that number about right, Catherine?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, we just got so hit after Katrina. Democrats got so hit after Katrina that I just think it's going to be really hard. And they have a, you know, legacy of political problems there, and their Democratic Party is very weak. I think they're just now restructuring completely. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think very tough row to hoe for the president in Louisiana.
Yep. Kim?
Yeah, 175,000 Democratic voters left the state of Louisiana after Katrina, and the Democratic Party, frankly, hasn't recovered from that, nor will they anytime soon.
Okay, we're going to move a little further west to Texas. Now, of course, 2 weeks ago, we discussed Texas in depth. They give Texas, or Romney, a 98.3% chance of winning. I do think Romney's going to win Texas, but I almost think that number ought to come down maybe to like 85. Now, that, of course, makes it an overwhelming favorite, but I get the sense there's a little bit of a Democratic trend in that state in other ways. And they're basically putting it within a point or two of Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. And I don't think it's the wasteland that those are at the Democratic ballot box. Tim, I'm going to come to you first for a few states. Do you think Texas, that number should be a little lower than 98.3?
Well, there's a case to be made for that. But the problem is that recent history probably dictates this high number because of the fact that not only have Democrats performed poorly in the state of Texas, well, since Jimmy Carter won it in 76, but also statewide Democrats have won no elections in several cycles now, and the Democrats actually need to break through and win something. I mean, you got to look over at Mississippi. There's been Democrats in statewide office there since there's been some in Texas, so you could make an argument that Mississippi ought to get the break and not Texas. The Democrats have got to win something in Texas is what I'm saying, David.
Yeah, I guess our people from Burnt Orange Report, like Catherine, come on, and they tell us, or Matt Glazer, and they tell us about how the mayor of Houston wins and runs statewide. It's credible. And they tell us about how they're making progress in the state house and the state senate, and how more seats have been won. And, you know, they can actually force coalition deals with Republicans to get moderate Republicans to be Speaker of the House. Bush had a lieutenant governor when he was governor there. And so there's just, they have some power in some ways. And it's a comeback. It's not like, you know, Mississippi was holding on, if you will. Alabama,
yeah,
it was holding on. There they hit their nadir, and they're bouncing back. Catherine, your thoughts on Texas?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the difference in Texas is that they have a number of large population centers, and those tend to be Democratic. So I can see why you might think that their numbers should be higher, and I tend to agree with you. But I think when you look, like Tim says, when you look at the statewide election results, it's a disappointment for Democrats. So, I mean,
yeah,
maybe those numbers should be a little lower, but ultimately the chances are slim that the president's going to win. Whether it's 85 or 98%, doesn't really matter. It's still lost.
Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and cross the Red River into Oklahoma. And Nate Silver at New York Times 538 gives Romney a 100% chance of winning Oklahoma. The president has no chance in Oklahoma, according to this. And you think about, okay, well, am I surprised? I don't know. Then you start looking to the north. It's a 99% chance in Kansas. And the Dakotas, one's as low as 94, and Montana's 83. And you're thinking, man, Oklahoma is kind of a southern and western state mixed. Why is Oklahoma so bad? I mean, does 100 just sound like a little extreme, Tim?
No, it doesn't. Oklahoma right now, along with Wyoming, Idaho, and Utah, are the four reddest of the red states in this country, especially in presidential elections. I'm going to tell you what, I don't believe President Obama could win Oklahoma if he were the only candidate on the ballot. So, you know, no, I got to agree with Nate Silver on this. That's a direct hit.
But
yeah,
I will say this in defense of Oklahoma real quick. If they could elect anybody for president right now, it probably would be a black man. It'd just be Kevin Durant, since he's pretty popular in Oklahoma. Catherine, 100, that sounds extreme, doesn't it?
Not to me. I mean, I think there's a couple things at play there. Obviously, it is a very red state. And while I haven't looked at the numbers, I suspect that the unemployment and housing situation has really affected the people in Oklahoma. I can't have jobs in Oklahoma right now.
Yeah, I don't know what Oklahoma's economy is like. It's really, it's kind of like, hey, it's bad all over, except some of the swing states you find out are doing a little better. And, of course, North Dakota has, like, 4% unemployment. Like, if you have no
When you only have, like, 100 people living there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm telling you, buy a ticket to Fargo if you don't have any hopes for a job. Apparently, they're doing good. I mean, it's not all dishwashing jobs. I mean, there's actually, like, Microsoft has a location there. I mean, it's actually Fargo's more... it's more the meets the eye, if you will. Well, let's continue to move now back east. We'll go up to Missouri, and that's, I guess, the most border of border states. And to me, it's one that really is a swing state. I don't think – I argued for Florida being 50-50. They have Missouri at 77.6. I'd put that number at maybe like a 55 Romney, maybe even a 57, a nice clean 20-point drop. Tim, is Missouri closer than 77.6 for Romney?
Yes, I think so. I'd go more in the 60-40 range because I think it's trending toward Romney. The only thing that's not making Romney put this state away is like the U.S. Senate race. There's going to be a barn burner, too. I think it'll hold will serve to hold those presidential numbers close like maybe it's going to do in Florida with Nelson. So I would say, though, it leans Romney, I don't know, 4 or 5 points maybe on election night. Just a shot in the dark there.
Yeah, I mean, Catherine, your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I think 78 is high, like Tim said, because of that Senate race. I think there's going to be a lot of attention as we get closer to the election. I think we're going to see a lot of attention on Missouri. So I think those numbers are a little skewed.
Okay. Well, let's continue to go a little further south into Arkansas. What we might have considered was a Democratic bastion at one time. The Clinton years are definitely over. And that's no more. This is definitely a trending Republican state, another one of those that's trending Republican as fast as it can be, if you will. They have that number in the high 90s, and, of course, I searched to look for something else, and that wasn't a good move. 97.5 chance. I'll give them that. I may even say you can go up to 98 on that one. We're trying to be nice at times and give Romney points. Here and there, since we're taking him away 10 and 20% at a time on some of the swing states. Catherine, I'll come back to you. Is that number right or wrong?
I think it's right. You know, it's, you know, the United States of Walmart over there, so I think the president has, it's a big long shot for the president, and I think those numbers are pretty accurate.
Yep, Tim?
Yeah, I got to agree. Arkansas was one of, what, four states where the president underperformed Senator Kerry from 04 to 08. I see nothing to indicate that they'll do anything but light this one up red as soon as the polls close. They'd be a case made for a 100%er there.
Yeah, maybe 100%, I guess, because if you put in the formula the fact that President Clinton did come from there and they have a Democratic governor, there's probably a few things holding it back from 100%.
Yeah.
But it's just not trending presidentially in the right way for us, if you will. Well, let's continue to move over to Kentucky. A 98.2 chance of winning, slightly worse than Arkansas. This is one that I just don't see. It's another backward momentum state, if you will. I don't see the president doing well. If you wanted to go to 99, I wouldn't qualm with that. Catherine, what do you think?
Yeah. I'm disappointed in Kentucky. I had hoped that they would turn, but it's not going to happen.
Not this year, at least. Now, they still have a Democratic governor. I mean, they have some things going for them, if you will.
Yeah.
But and then, of course, if they put Rand Paul on the ticket, this might move up a little even higher to 99.9, although Tim seems to be laughing at that idea.
You okay, okay over there, Tim?
The Democrats can only dream that Romney will put Rand Paul on the ticket. You could just hear him in rooms all over the country going, yay, when he did. Anyway, this is an odd state, Kentucky. Let's take Bill Clinton out of the picture. He won the state a couple of times, but that was an anomaly. Normally, Kentucky votes Democratic in a lot of the local and statewide elections, and most of the time they vote Republican in presidential elections. These are the same people doing this. I have no explanation for it. Do you, David?
No, it's just the president's just not popular in those mountain states, if you will, like Kentucky. I mean, we're going to cover West Virginia pretty quick here, and those states are just demographically bad for the president for whatever reason. Well, let's continue to move on, and since I've mentioned it, let's go to West Virginia. They have the number at 91.5. Now, of course, West Virginia has a lot of union voters, and it has deep Democratic roots. It has a Democratic governor. It has two Democratic senators. But the president has just never done well in West Virginia, and I don't see it being close this time. This is another one where they might as well give Romney another 6-7 points. What do you think, Catherine?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think for whatever reason, the president's just—they just don't like him. I don't know if it's a race thing or what, but they don't like him.
Yeah, they.
Yeah,
like
I mean, I'd give him 97, 98.
Yeah, Tim, your thoughts on West Virginia?
Well, they haven't voted Democratic since 1996. They're another one of those states that trends Republicans nowadays in presidential elections and votes for Democrats in every other election, and it's the same voters doing it. It's like Kentucky all over again. I wonder why the Hatfields and McCoys even had a feud, you know. No chance there.
Yes, well, we'll continue to move through. Let's make it go to Virginia next. Virginia, that is the only blue state on the map for the southern and border states, if you will. I guess we ought to go to Maryland as well, since David Wissing and comes on the show and we've talked Maryland politics. But Virginia, of the, traditional southern states, the only one, they give the president a 62.9% chance of winning. I heard today that one of the people on Chris Matthews said that the Senate race was going to be one of the closest, and as the Senate race went, so would the presidential race. It was almost like he thought it was more of a 50-50 race, if you will. So I almost think that 63% seems a little high. Tim, do you think 63 seems high for the president?
Absolutely. This race is anywhere from dead even to 3 points, and no more than that, and no more in that U.S. Senate race, too. Those two races are going to be mirror images of each other and are going to go late into the night. That's going to be a close one. And by the way, I'd like to say happy birthday to David Wissing. Today's his birthday, so.
Oh, well,
our friend in Maryland, yeah. But Virginia's too close to call, David.
Okay. Well, Catherine, Virginia, what do you think?
Too close to call. That and Missouri are going to be our late nights in November.
Yeah, I just was surprised by 63. I want to take some points away from Romney in some places, but this is one where I think they might have undersold him. We shall see how it continues to flesh out. let's go up to Maryland. I'm sorry, I forgot that that was a border state, if you will. They give the president a 99.8% chance of winning. I mean, it's the mirror image of Alabama. I don't study a lot of Maryland politics. That almost seems a little high, like it should be like 85
mm-hmm.
or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it that mm-hmm. is it that rock solid Democratic, Tim?
It is. Where I blog and who I talk to all the time, and that is one of the bluest of the blue states, all of those government workers and stuff in those counties surrounding Washington, D.C., and Baltimore also is a big Democratic town, and that state is solid blue. You could really make a case for 100%, even the worst Democratic candidates in the worst Democratic years are probably going to take the state of Maryland. That's a slam dunk for the president.
Okay, we've got about 4 minutes, and we've got about four states, so let's go quick. Tennessee, 98.3. Tennessee, since Harold Ford Jr. lost, it's never seemed very Democratic in a lot of ways. That number seems about right. Catherine?
Yeah. I'll go with that.
Yeah, it's good enough. We're trying to save time on a few of these states. Tim?
Yeah, 20-point win for Romney there.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's not a real close one. We'll go to another one, South Carolina, 96.7, a state that I think we used to would have compared to Alabama and Mississippi, but it's 3 or 4 points under those states, showing that they've had some Democratic trend. I might even go down to say 95, if you will, because, of course, I'm just like round numbers, but I'm sure there's some formula there. Catherine, what do you think?
I think Romney's going to win it, but I don't know if that number is a little high.
Yeah. Tim?
I think Romney wins that state by 8 to 11 points. So, yeah, that percentage that Silver gives is a little bit high.
Okay, now let's go to the other Carolina. They give Romney a 72.1 chance of winning, even though the president carried North Carolina, and the governor's race in which the Democratic candidate just got into the race when the current governor decided not to run. That's a single-digit race, according to a poll put out. North Carolina, I think Romney's ahead right now, but I don't think it's by this type of margin where you could justify a 72% chance of winning. Catherine, what do you think?
I agree. I think it's going to be a little tighter than that. I suspect Romney will take it, but I think we might be looking at that. We might be watching that on election night. You know, it'll probably come in early, but I don't think it's going to be a given.
Yeah, and Tim?
Yeah, well, I think we're in the 3 to 5 point range on election night, David, for trending Romney. But, you know, if the thing turns back toward the president, we could be looking at another one of those just flip a coin to see who wins the state kind of nuts.
Yep. And then the final state, our home state of Georgia, 97.1. And I could look at this in several ways. I could say, hey, what happened last presidential election? It was a single-digit race. The U.S. Senate race got pushed into a runoff. If I was looking at solely at those numbers and knowing the Democratic shifts or demographic shifts of Georgia, I might say, hey, I'd give Romney a 65% chance of winning. But then if I look at the 2010 results and I look at the fact that we don't hold any statewide offices, if I look at the recent polls on the race, I'd say, yeah, it's probably about 98%. I'd even go up. Tim, what am I to believe?
Well, here's what I believe. Romney wins the state by only about 8 points, but it's a solid 8-point win, one that you can put in stone. The president can get to a certain point and no further, and that's just the fact of the matter in Georgia right now. Right, Catherine?
That's exactly what I think. I mean, I think it'll be, you know, 8-9 points, but you know, it's that 42%. You know, that's 42-43%. That's what we've got here.
Yeah, I tell you this, but they always talk
unless
about,
we do unless we have a lot of money to to do a lot of work between now and November, and I just don't think that's happening.
Basically, they keep talking about, you know, the president's campaign wanting to expand the map. They always mentioned early on Arizona and Georgia. I have to think that the money might have been spent in Georgia now gets spent in Missouri, if it gets spent in a map expansion state. Even a state like Montana gets the money. Or if you still said, I want to keep the money in the Deep South, you could take the money and spend it in Columbia, Greenville, Charleston. It would go a lot further than it would in Atlanta. And spend
David,
it somewhere
you
else.
Hit on
I don't
something.
Think Georgia's a
you,
play.
You hit on something. The money might go to Montana because we don't have a tight U.S. Senate race this year.
Mm-hmm.
Here.
That's
and
true, too. Yeah, there's, yeah, other than John Barrow's congressional race, there's nothing on the federal
right.
level in play, if you will.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, we're into recording, and I hate that for our live listeners. We had just a big number of live listeners this week, and so maybe they can catch the tail end on the recorded podcast that should be available in minutes. So for the Kudzu Vine, this is Dave McLaughlin. Good evening.
Good night, guys.
Happy Father's Day, everybody.